Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. I am your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Our guest today is Richard Harris, and we speak with him about his new bestseller, The Seller's Journey, your guidebook to closing more deals using neat selling.
The difference is I have to earn the right to ask those questions. I have to do it in a non-pushy, non-cheesy car salesman point way. I don't sell much of anything. I exchange ideas, and then they decide if they like my idea or not. And I know how to present my idea the best way possible that doesn't feel manipulative, that doesn't feel pushy, that doesn't feel obnoxious. And I give them a way out. I'm like, if you don't want it, just tell me. I don't need to hound you.
Richard Harris is a multi-award-winning sales leadership expert and trainer who has fundamentally reshaped how modern companies approach sales conversations and customer engagement. As the founder of the Harris Consulting Group, he has earned recognition as a 4-time Salesforce sales leader and 5-time AAISP top sales leader for his innovative Earn the Right methodology, which transforms how sales teams navigate customer relationships and drive revenue. Harris's client portfolio spans Fortune 500 enterprises like General Electric, Visa, and Salesforce to high-growth startups such as Dusty Robotics and Lattice. Beyond his consulting work, Harris is the co-founder of Surf and Sales and has established himself as a prominent voice in the sales community through his widely followed podcast of the same name, which has aired over 400 episodes. His thought leadership and expertise have made him a sought-after guest speaker on numerous business and sales podcasts. A passionate advocate for mental health awareness in sales, Harris balances his professional achievements with his role as a husband and a father of 2 sons. His approach to sales leadership emphasizes both high performance and human-centric values, making him one of the most respected voices in modern sales transformation. Now, on to this truly insightful session with Richard Harris. Richard, welcome to Bits About Books. We have waited a long time to get you on the show, and I'm delighted that you're here.
I'm sorry it took me so long to get here, but I'm excited, and thank you for asking me to be on it.
You know, I talk to a lot of authors, and one of my favorite things is to talk to them about their writing process. And that's also sort of a defining feature of the podcast, because I don't think anywhere else that is discussed. And people love it, because when you actually say, look, this is what happened, I was in a workshop and this triggered and I did this and so on, right? So it's always very exciting, because it's sort of like making of the movie. That's why you go and say, okay, how was it made? And then you sort of connect it with what you're reading, right? So that's the idea. So I know that the system that you're talking of, the neat system, is your trademark of your company.
Right.
Which I presume you would have done some time back. It was not something which is new.
Correct.
And we'll go into that. I mean, when did you do that and so on? But what made you think that it's time now to write a book to tell people about it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know you tell me, but I started writing a book several years before I got to this book. Right. I knew and the reason is in the business that I'm in sales training and consulting, I'm not going in to write a New York Times bestseller. Right. Mm. I'm going in to write something that's to help a very specific part of a community that I am, which is the sales world, and trying to help others, you know, elevate their game. The book for me, the reason I wrote it was more, were twofold. One, help people. And two, it sort of acted as a stronger validation and a little bit of a calling card for me. I'd already been in the sales training consulting space for 6 years or so. And it was kind of like, well, what's the next thing I could do? You know, selfishly that yes, it helps me, but it does help other people, right? Like there's a give and get there. And it was never about, am I going to make a ton of money? You know, I don't know, maybe in 10 years, I'll make my money back from what I spent to write this book, right? Because when you do the self-published thing, that's kind of how it goes, you know. Yeah. And I started writing something in 2019, maybe. I didn't get super serious about this until 2022, 23. So, and the reason there is it's hard to write a book.
Yeah.
If you've never done it, it's hard to get those thoughts out on paper where you're trying to put the idea down, but then you start to self-edit while you're trying to write the book, and you just sort of start to confuse yourself. And then you have all these ideas that you get on paper, and then you start to, wait, no, this should go first. No, this should go first. And then you get all distracted by this. Oh, here's a topic I need to do, and it's fresh in my mind. I got to go. Like, I just, that was my process, which was very painful. Mm. Now, if I had to write another book, I'd understand the process of writing it and could do it better. But that might be a very long answer to your question, but that's sort of the genesis of it.
No, this is great, because a lot of people who think they have an idea and they want to write a book, I mean, you know, some very interesting things have come out, just like what you said. Mm-hmm. Many interesting things came out. There are authors who have come here and said, you know, I decided I'm not going to write a 300-page book, and I wrote a 70-page book because I think that's all that it needed.
Right.
You know, so people have perspectives and people try different experiments. So I think there's a great deal to learn from the fact, if for instance, somebody is trying to write a book and going through exactly what you went through, he will know that it's not happening in isolation with him, but this is generally what happens when you write your first book.
Right.
It's fine.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely, and I have a lot of friends who've written books, and they told me that this is what they went through. And I can't decide if they corrupted me and it forced me to go through the same pains they did, or if I was just too obnoxious and egotistical to think that won't happen to me. Sure enough, you know.
That's a nice one. So, yeah. So tell me, I mean, you 2019, you thought you'll write the book. What did you start? Did you start by saying, okay, I'll write the chapters, or I have these three ideas. I'll first write that.
You know, that's a really good question. It was a very different type of book at that point. Like, you know, there are kind of two parts to my book. One is sort of the psychological part of understanding sales and giving yourself this space and grace to be a human. And then there's this other part that's tactical, right? Here's how you handle these conversations. And the first attempt at a book was going to be very tactical. Like, these are the rules to follow, or these are the laws. I was trying to get creative, like a 10 commandments kind of a thing, right? And it's good, and it's good content, and I've gone back and looked at it, and I could probably go write it better now. But then that's when I got in my own way, right? You come up with all these ideas, and you don't know where to start and where to focus, and then it's just a slog, too. Like, it's all in your head. And it's like, man, if someone could just go into my head and pull it out in 30 seconds, that's my book. But to sit down and manually do it, that was very painful for me. Creating that space and time, I felt like I wasn't really working if I was working on a book. And so I had some mind games in my head. So I went through two or three different things to get there. And so it wasn't what, you know, and you tell me, I think a lot of people who write, or specifically write a book, maybe even if, you know, you're a journalist, where you start is nothing like where you end. You kind of have to work yourself out of the forest with these initial ideas, and then you find your path to what you're really going to focus on and write about. But that's my experience. I don't know if that's the same for everybody or not, but maybe you've talked to a lot of authors. Maybe that sounds familiar.
Yes. And everybody has a different take. For instance, right. There are a lot of people, I mean, you write blogs. There are many authors who have actually fashioned a book literally out of the blogs they've written.
And I thought of that too. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
People take different paths, and by the time they're writing the blog, they know that, okay, these 20 topics will make the book, and they possibly didn't write the blogs in the order in which the chapters finally appeared.
Right.
Because they found a more cogent way of putting it together.
Right.
To be factual, most first books go pretty much through the same process that you have.
Oh, well, now I don't feel so bad.
you know, I think you were very succinct when you said the pulls while I'm writing this, there is this new idea that has come, and, right. and then you think compelled to write that, and then you have left this, and you have lost the thread, and then you are trying to come back to it, and then you don't like it at all. Then you say, okay, this is rubbish. I need to rewrite this whole thing, and this is a completely confusing, conflicting phase, which right. you can't share with anybody because it's not even a draft that you can share, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's like I can sit there and tell people about it, and they'll. You know, even my friends who've written books, like, yeah, I know you've got people and you yeah. can commiserate in it, but there's not much someone can do. Yeah. You know, the answer is, man, I understand, but I don't have any advice for you and I wish you luck. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's kind of it. So
did you have a process like I will write every weekend or I'll write first thing 1 hour every morning?
No, I'm too ADHD for that. I did have time on my calendar. Here's how it worked for me. First, I got to a certain point and then I stopped. And then I reached out to a friend of mine and she authors things for people and she ghost wrote my first version of the book, right? She interviewed me and she wrote it, all that kind of stuff. Then I took that manuscript and I went and found the publisher I ended up working with. I asked around and here's a publisher and I sent it off to them. And so the book was 70 to 80% done by the time I actually gave it to a publisher. Mm. So that really what I gave them, it was really more on the rewrites and the flow and the organization of the book and maybe a little bit of like go deeper here or let's pull this part out, right? Mm. Not a ton. So by the time I actually got it to the publisher, I think the hardest part had been done. Right. Once I got the book to the publisher and they started making the suggestions, that part was easy for me to get back to them on.
Right. The ideating was over. This is where you're executing very specific requirements that has been put to you.
Right. Yes. The hard part was done. Right.
Yes.
If I went back and wrote a book now, I could probably do it in 6 months from beginning to end. This was a 2-year process. And that's because of the starting and the stopping and the starting and the stopping. And then all that, you know, it took me 2 years just to get the book to the publisher in a right. way that, and that's on me. That's nobody else. You know, I got frustrated with myself. I'm like, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore, whatever. Right. So, yeah. But now that I understand the process, it's not nearly as hard in my head, it's not nearly as hard. I don't know. Second child's always easier, right?
Like yeah, like absolutely. That. Absolutely. Because you don't care so much.
Right.
So. No, I'm just kidding.
We won't tell our kids that, but yes, you're right.
Of course. So. Well, if you did the next book, what will your 6 months, what do you think your 6 months process will look like?
Well, I think I would certainly write down the topics of the chapters that I want to write. I would start to write one chapter at a time, right? I would worry less about the organizational flow of the chapters. And then I'd be able to hand it off to my publisher and have them say, here's the flow. You know, I'm pretty good at organizing stuff into a flow. So after I wrote it, then I would focus on that. Right. And I would also, you know, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time, right? I would be like, okay, I'm going to do this chapter this week, this chapter this week. Because I'm willing to bet I could bang out a chapter in about an hour, hour and a half, right? Maybe even faster, depending on how I think about it. But I'd have enough down that my publisher would be able to go, you need to write more about this. You need to add more. And so I think that's what my first draft would look like. And I think I could get that done pretty quick. And then it's really just a back and forth on the editing process, right? Like it's funny. They sent me the book and they said, okay, you know, we've done all the proofreading. You need to go read it again to proofread it. I'm like, I'm not reading my book to proofread it. That's what I paid you for. If there's a typo in there, then so be it. Like, I don't care. Right. Like these are salespeople. These, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, create the literary get on some literary list, right? So, so I would cut out some of the minutia that I know I don't care about.
Right.
Like, so far as I know, nobody's criticized my book because there's a punctuation point off. And if they did, like, okay, fine. Email me. I'll Venmo you your $12. Like, that's the least, you are the least of my concerns when I have that kind of a critic.
Right.
And I had to kind of convince my publishers of that a little bit too. I'm like, you guys are way, like, you're overthinking this. Like, no, they don't care. Like, and by the time they want to criticize me, they've already bought the book. Like, but I'm also unique in that sense too, because literally in the first page of my book, I give people my email address and I tell them, if you think the book sucks, email me. I'll give you your money back. Like, I'll send you your money. If you don't think if you don't think $12, you're going to get $12 of value out of this. Okay, fine. So that's kind of where I don't care about certain parts and why I think I can do it faster.
Of course. And anyway, I mean, punctuation is the least of the issue. And as you rightly said, I mean, nobody's going to learn less or more because the punctuation is put wrongly in one place or not put there.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, you're not writing a code for a SpaceX to take off. I mean, one punctuation.
Right, yeah, exactly. I'm not writing code. That's a great example. I'm not writing a computer code here.
Exactly. So you're fine. Right. This is a good segue to get into the book itself. But before you talk about it, talk about when did you think that you have a process that you have discovered in NEAT and you should go and register it, copyright it.
Articulate it and all that stuff. I want to say it was around 2015, 16, maybe 17. And again, I've been in the business for a while. Differentiation matters in our business.
Of course.
Not a lot's really changed in the sales world, right, since Mesopotamia. Like, there's still products and goods and services, and there's a market for which you go and you sell those and buy those things. And so I was looking for some level of differentiation, and I didn't like what I was seeing out there. And I just sort of, I don't even know how, it just sort of started to come to me of need, the economic impact of that need, gaining access to authority and timeline. And that economic impact and access to authority were two of the big differentiators for me, because people talk about it in sales. You got to get to authority. You got to get to authority. Who's the authority figure? And I'm like, no. You have to get access to that person, and you're never going to start with that person in most cases in sales. So that's where access came in. Economic impact, that came to me because I just felt like it resonated that when we are trying to sell things to people and people want to buy them, they're doing it because it's going to have some level of impact. For what I do, there is an economic impact, meaning I'm trying to help that company close more business,
right?
Which means that their sales team is trying to close more business, and their customer, my customer's customers, have some economic impact for not having a particular service available, a particular device available. And so it became a way to articulate it. And it became a way to articulate, to dollarize the pain. So that's where it all came from. But at a highest level, it was like, how am I going to differentiate myself from every other person that's out there? Right.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what it was going to do, what it was going to, would it become popular? Would it just be a little niche thing that Richard discovered, that nobody cares about, but it makes them different. And now people talk about it. So it's sort of, it was never meant to be. It was never meant to be like, oh, the next greatest and latest process. It just sort of was something for me to differentiate myself, and then it sort of worked its way into that.
Sure. I understand. So let's get back to the book.
Mm-hmm.
You start by talking about people not really appreciating or understanding the role of sales and in social settings, how difficult it is to communicate to friends and family and other people that you are meeting that I'm in sales? And yeah. what does that communicate to them?
Right.
So talk about a bit about that.
So the first title of the book was actually going to be called Yes, I'm in Sales. That was the first title. Because I think we all carry this burden that salespeople are looked down upon, we're frowned upon, it's not a great profession. And we carry that burden with us. And so that was sort of where I was going to call it, Yes, I'm in Sales. I was like, no, you got to stand up and say it. Like, be proud of what you do. I don't know anybody who's a lawyer who's not proud to be a lawyer, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they get the jokes, right? You know, same thing about a doctor. And then I also realized, like, you know, it's like you're at a party and someone says, well, what do you do? And everybody's like, I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm in sales. And they don't know how to even react. Like, they think they, like, stepped in a pile of poo, right? Like, they really do. And I decided, like, that's just not the mentality. Like, you know, I do more good for the world and the economy than most doctors and lawyers will ever think of doing. I've trained thousands of people who don't need a college education, and some who do, to make billions of dollars for their companies, money for themselves, to provide for their family, to send their kids to school. And it's all altruistic. There's not a doctor or lawyer who can say that they do that. You know, there might be the doctor who, you know, operates on, William Hawking's brain, or, you know, somebody who's that valuable to the world at large. But for the most part, they're not. They're just patients.
Right.
And for the most part, my people are salespeople. Like, that's, you know, I'm not out there, you know, saving the next heart surgeon, right? Mm. But I don't know of another profession that can put so much energy into the world for which we all live and buy and sell as consumers that does more good than sales. I cannot find another profession that does that. And that to me is what it means to be, yes, I'm in sales. That's what it means.
Yeah, I think that's very powerful. I guess the perception of sales of, I mean, I was talking to somebody yesterday for the same podcast, and he said that politicians, lawyers, and salespeople are the least trusted people.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah, that's an old joke.
I don't know which study is referred to, but everybody refers to this study. I believe there is something somewhere. I mean, I don't know. I can't quote which study that is.
Well, I'll tell you where I think it started, right? From a sales perspective, because I say the same thing, right? Where the, you know, people don't think or trust us. And again, it's not so from the American point of view, right? You know, The Grapes of Wrath, right, by John Steinbeck, literary, you know, author in the U.S., right? Mm-hmm. And here in the United States, it's a very popular book. It's one of the, you know, quintessential books that most high schoolers read, kind of a thing. And I'd never read it. My high school, I don't know why our school didn't do it. But there's a single chapter in there, for those who don't know, it's about the story of this family, the Jodes, moving from the Oklahoma Dust Bowl to California, where everything was supposed to be perfect and rosy and you could make money picking oranges and lemons, and it was all a lie. It was all a lie, right? But people would go and they'd go buy this used car, literally. And there's an entire chapter dedicated to the slick, fast-talking salesperson selling, you know, these farmers who have no clue or frame of reference, who've never had a car, bought a car, don't know anything about really fixing a car, and just how he's lying to them about why this car is so great, right? Oh my God, these tires are fantastic. Meanwhile, the tires are going to last 20 miles, right? Oh my God, the car is in great shape. We had someone check the engine and check the oil. Meanwhile, there's no fresh oil in it. Like, as this whole chapter dedicated to it. So my belief is that at least here in the United States, because for generations, so many people have read that book, that was one part that perpetuated the stereotype. Mm. It's not the only reason, but it's the biggest piece of evidence I've found that goes, oh, well, maybe this is a big reason why people don't like or trust salespeople. So You know, and believe me, look, I've been, you know, I've had bad salespeople try to lie to me too. So I know that it exists. I know that it existed before the Grapes of Wrath, after the Grapes of Wrath, right? Like, you know, history is, you know, there's tons of terrible sales examples out there in history if you really stop and think about it. But that was just one place where it's sort of like, okay, that's concrete. I know where that's coming from.
Right, right. And I guess people also look at sales as a transient career a lot of times.
Yes, yes. No, you know, I'm different, right? I was one of the few people who kind of knew I was going to go into sales and into business. Most, you know, my joke is that oftentimes people fall into sales from a dumpster fire of other failed careers, right? They haven't been able to get the traction they wanted around this or around that or around this. And in a lot of cases, people finally wake up and go, wow, you can make a lot of money in sales. And you definitely don't have to be, you know, the most technically smartest person in the room. Like, I'm never going to be, to your point, I'm never going to write code. That's not my thing. I can talk to developers who buy from me a lot, or, you know, help a team that sells to developers, but I'm not going to be that type of smart, right? I'm a different type of smart.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's a really interesting thing. So most people don't necessarily desire to go into sales. They fall into it. And then they actually realize that they love it and they like it and that they can make some money at it. Right? Right. It's not as dirty a profession as people think it is.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, it just literally just now, it's kind of making me think, gosh, if I had to do a survey of who has a less favorable view in society, a prostitute or a salesperson, what would people choose? Right. Like, I have no idea. I bet it's 50-50. Right. So, because they probably, my hypothesis is that they'd be like, well, at least the prostitute's being honest about what they do in their life. I'm like, what? Like, you know, that's my hypothesis. So anyway.
Interesting one. Yeah. Yeah.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
Let's say I decide to get a new TV, or I decide, or I'm going to start researching a new TV or a new car, or I need software. Well, the entire reason you're going to go into that journey is because you have some experience that you're trying to correct or fix or prevent from happening. There is no buyer's journey. The only part of the journey that might exist is the moment you type something into Google. But even then, that's minuscule because you're trying to enhance your experience.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful, and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it. So let's dive in a bit more about the fact that you think that there is a seller's journey, which is the book, the book is about, and there is no buyer's journey.
Yeah.
And you know, it's controversial, right? I mean, there's a lot that one can do with that one line in the book. Okay.
That's the whole purpose. Yeah. I dropped it at this conference a couple of months ago and you could see half the room gasp and the other half, well, I would say a third of the room gasped. A third of the room was like, didn't believe me. And another third were like, yes, finally someone said it. Right. So the yes, it's meant to be controversial. It's meant to spark a conversation, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? And that's what's good, right? It's not, I will defend my argument, but it doesn't mean I have to be right. I just want to encourage people to think.
Yeah.
There's only a buyer's experience through a seller's journey. Even if I'm looking, let's say I decide to get a new TV, or I decide, or I'm going to start researching a new TV or a new car, or I need software. Well, the entire reason you're going to go into that journey is because you have some experience that you're trying to correct or fix or prevent from happening. There is no buyer's journey. The only part of the journey that might exist is the moment you type something into Google. But even then, that's minuscule because you're trying to enhance your experience. The moment you Google something, you're now on the seller's journey. You're looking at what the marketing team has put in for SEO. You're looking at what marketing has put in for SEM, for Google AdWords. You're, you know, looking at all the things that pop up so you can do your research. And you click on the link based on what feels like the right link. That's an experience. That's a feelings are experiences and emotions. And so that's where I believe that there's no such thing as a buyer's journey. There's only a buyer's experience through a seller's journey. We've all been through terrible sales journeys because it gave us a bad buyer's experience. We got tons of apps on our phones that we don't use because it's a terrible app. That's not because you went on a bad buyer's journey. It meant you had a bad buyer's experience. So that's my philosophy on this. And you know, I love to talk about it. I love people to call me out on it and engage on it. But, you know, that's where it comes from for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. And since I promised that I'm not going to challenge you on this today.
Please, go ahead, challenge me. I don't care.
No, doesn't mean I'll not come back to you tomorrow for another chat.
Okay.
No. That's the stated purpose. So tell me about this process you think is happening. Because while you I mean, I get what you're saying in terms of the buyer's experience, but buyers do have a process.
Sure.
Journey is a fancy word. Okay. I mean, like everything in sales, I mean, we need to sort of make it a look little fancy, more attractive. It is debatable whether the seller has a journey at all. I mean, it may be a process he's trying to follow. So it's only play on words. I'll leave it at that. But that's not the question. The question is, what is and this I'm asking you as a professional who has seen this so close and for so long.
Sure.
You know, when we talk of sales, it appears that we salespeople are selling, right? We are selling.
That's the perception. I agree.
Yeah. No sale happens unless a buyer signs on the dotted line.
Yeah.
It appears we are selling, but it is actually a two-way process, right? Our selling process has to meet the buyer's experience to your terminology, and somewhere it sort of fits into each other.
Yes.
And a transaction happens.
Correct.
Right? Now, how do you think in this process of understanding the seller's journey, we may be ignoring the fact that we are not fully in control of this journey?
The only thing that I don't think I'm in control of is their budget or what they really want to accomplish, because lots of times they don't know what they don't know. So there's very little in the way that I sell and the process that I go through and the process that I teach that only thing I don't have control over is the amount of information they're going to give me. And it's my job to get them to give me the information. That's that part where you say they sort of come together, right? Through trust, right? Like, as I always say, you know, our job in sales is to get people to fall in trust with us, not to fall in love with this. They can fall in love with the results. They can fall in love with the TV or the car or the software, whatever. But they got to fall in trust with me.
Yeah.
So what I can control far more than most people think as a salesperson. I can control the time of the call. I can control what answers they're going to give me based on the questions. I can control the ability to organize the entire conversation based on how I know to make it work so that they do answer those questions. And I have the ability, and anybody has the ability, to make it not manipulative, but to just be a conversation.
Yeah.
Right. There, that, so that I control far more than I think people think a salesperson can control. And I think salespeople can control far more. Now, the difference is, comes to that experience, right? The difference is I have to earn the right to ask those questions. I have to do it in a non-pushy, non-cheesy car salesman point way. I don't sell much of anything. I exchange ideas, and then they decide if they like my idea or not. And I know how to present my idea the best way possible that doesn't feel manipulative, that doesn't feel pushy, that doesn't feel obnoxious. And I give them a way out. I'm like, if you don't want it, just tell me. I'm not going to, I don't need to hound you. I don't need to send you 1,000 emails. Like, you know, it's what's going to happen. Right. So, you know, so for example, here's a level of control, right? Someone's like, oh, Richard, you know what? Just send me an email with your information. Happy to send you that email. What, here are three things I could send you. What would you like? Okay, send me that. Great. Now, you know, when I send you this email, I'm going to call you every day, three times a day to see if you got my email and to see if we're going to continue the conversation. So before I send you this email, you know, that's what's going to happen. Do you really want me to send you the email? Because if you don't, that's fine. I won't bother you. Right? That's me in complete control of the entire conversation. Right? Now, they can bow out or they can say yes. But now I have no guilt, no shame, no concern, because I gave them their chance to say no. Now, at some other point, I will come along and says, well, it seems like you're not that interested. That's totally fine. You know, you let me know when you want to talk again. But I have far more control. I think salespeople have far more control over the process and the journey and creating the right buyer's experience than they ever give themselves credit for.
So would you say, I mean, I know this is a loaded question, but
those are the best ones.
Being a trainer, why is it that salespeople, I mean, what you're telling me is not rocket science.
Right.
What you're telling me is pretty much what we do as human beings with each other.
Yes. I mean, that's the other part of my book is like, we just need to bring humanity back into sales. Like, just be a human.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I could have reached out to you 10 times and you would have said, yes, Shumanjan, I'll do the podcast. And then you don't. Then at some point I'll say, hey, Richard, if this is sort of getting bothersome, I think let me know when you're. I think that's what I would do. I mean, because I understand a man may be busy. Yeah. He has some other priorities, whatever. I mean, that's fine. So we know that most people don't come with a professional training as a salesperson.
Correct.
Right. So nobody's coming with a sales degree.
Yes.
Unlike a lawyer or a doctor, where it's pretty defined, you have dedicated your time, 10 years here, 7 years here. You are a lawyer. I can become a salesperson out of high school because I can, right?
Yes.
Now, does that sort of make it imperative that serious training is necessary for people to do just what you said? To be able to understand that, because it's not coming to them naturally, because they are hounding, they are writing those 100 mails, they're doing exactly the opposite of what you just said.
Yes, yes. So you're 100% right. So at a statistical level, there's 4,000-ish universities in the United States. I think when I wrote the book, the research said there were somewhere between 300 and 400 that had sales courses, and maybe 200 that had a degree in sales. So you can get a degree in sales and you go learn all these things about a sales process and the different methodologies and all that stuff and the CRMs. And there is, you now can get a diploma to your point, like a lawyer or a doctor.
Yeah.
Otherwise you have to go learn through process and elimination and experience, right? It's no different than a doctor or a lawyer, right? Like in the same way, there's a process. If I'm going in to have heart surgery, there's a very specific process I got to go through as a patient. Yeah. And I really want my doctor to know that process. I really want, you know, and I need multiple doctors and I need an anesthesiologist and I want the nurse, you know, to know what their role is, because I don't want them to, you know, mess something up, right? You know, so there's a process that needs to occur. And we all experience that. We all know what that is. It's very different though in sales because we have so much less exposure to it. Right. And if you think about it, I've never thought about it this way, but even now as a kid, you know, you take your kids to a pediatrician early on, right? And there's a process for that. And the kids learn that this is part of life, yeah. Right? That doesn't you don't get that level of exposure around sales in life until much later in your life.
Yeah.
So it can be learned. It can be taught. Can you teach everybody how to be a salesperson? You can, but that doesn't mean they want to do it. You know, there's a difference between having the skill and having the will.
Right.
You know, I've got the skill to throw a baseball, right? I got the skill to hit a baseball. I have the will to go practice 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
Right? Right. You know, one of my kids is a really good athlete, but his biggest challenges, he doesn't want to put in the extra effort, right? He'd rather be on video games. And that, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, that's who he is. Like, I can't force him to go do it. I have conversations with him about it, but ultimately it's on him.
Yeah, true. So briefly tell me about the process that you talk about in the book in chapter 3. What is this process, according to you?
The process, you know, there's this difference between a method, sales methodology, a sales process, and a sales philosophy, right? So a sales process is what are the stages of to close a deal, right? There's qualification, discovery, selection, negotiation, and closing, right? Like that's the main part of the sales funnel.
Right.
So you have to have this process. Well, then you can use a methodology to go through that process, right? There's NEAT, there's MEDIC, there's BANT, there's gap selling, there's all these methodologies. And then there's, you know, the philosophy, as I like to call it. And for me, the process is always the same, right? I have people come in and they're like, hey, help us redo this process. And that's fine. But I think that sometimes we overcomplicate it. But MEDIC is probably the only one that could be both a methodology and a process in terms of following certain letters. But that may be overly complex for some organizations. Mm. So you have to decide, well, what is your process, right? What is the journey? What is the seller's journey that a salesperson has to take a customer through to close that deal? And how do I do it in such a way that provides a great experience? Right? So for me, I don't believe that you have to rip and replace things. If you've got a MEDIC sales process, don't rip and replace it with NEAT. That's silly. The reason MEDIC's not working is twofold. One, it's either too complex because you've got a short sales cycle, or B, nobody's coaching to it. Mm. So ripping and replacing MEDIC for anything else, we don't know that that's going to be any better if you're not going to coach to the new thing any more than you did the old thing.
Sure.
Right. So there's a lot of times where I feel like NEAT is, in some cases, it's a process. In some cases, it's a methodology. In some, it's just a philosophy that bolts on to whatever else you're doing. Because I said earlier, you know, not a lot's changed, right? It's just the approach to that, to sales that we take.
Right. Let's follow up with the next chapter. Where you talk about sales being personal, it's always personal.
Yeah.
I want to add to that by asking this, that we know that large corporations, while you'd like to believe that we are selling to one person, it's really not that. There are many people involved in the decision-making process.
Yes.
And And while no one person has the ability to say yes, but every person has a veto, which can derail the entire process.
Yes.
So that's how it works, that no one person can help you sell, but one person can veto you and you're out of the process. So elaborate a little more. How can you be personal with, say, a committee of five people?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things. One is that sales isn't personal, but so is buying. Buying is very personal. It's like, I got to give up this money for that. That's emotional.
Yeah.
Purchasing is an emotional experience. There is a feeling. You go and you see something on sale, and the first thing that pops in your head is, oh my God, that feels like a bargain. Then you stop to think, how's that going to look on me if it's clothing, right? Now, it can go the other way. Oh my God, I really like how that looks. Hmm. What's the price? Oh my God, that's a bargain. And I buy it without trying on. Okay. Or, you know, oh my God, that's too expensive. I'm not even going to try it on.
Right.
So that's the first. I want to make sure that everybody knows it's a two-way street on this emotional piece.
Right.
The key piece in sales that I talk about all the time these days is it doesn't matter who the decision maker is. This goes back to access to authority. I teach reps, particularly when there's a committee. Look, every first meeting is going to end like this. Even if it's, you know, occasionally there's a one call close, right? That might work. But every sales conversation ends with, yeah, I'm going to take this back to my team and get their opinion. And salespeople have been taught the worst thing ever, which is, great, well, who's the decision maker on the team? Could I get a chance to be in the meeting? Could I try to talk to them first? Blah, 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 blah. Terrible, 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 terrible. I literally want you to just turn around and go, great, when you know, I want you to say this. Hey, I know when we get off the call, you're probably going to go take this back to your team, right? And they're going to go, yeah. I'm like, great. Who's the most skeptical person on the team and what are they the most skeptical about? And now you're making them visualize them being in this meeting in a conference room in someone's office, sitting there with those three or four other people, and they know exactly who's going to be one of the naysayers.
Yeah.
And in some case, and they will always answer the question. And sometimes they'll even say, well, I'm the most skeptical. Great. I'd love to hear that. Now I know, well, what are you skeptical about? Right. But they'll say, oh, that's going to be Bob or that's going to be Sarah. And they're going to be skeptical about these things. Okay, great. So would you like me to give you a little bit of information so that they don't turn around and ask you about that and you become a ping pong ball going back and forth between us? And everybody laughs when you say that because they've all been the ping pong ball. Nobody wants to be a fucking ping pong ball. Like, nobody does. So that's, to me, how you work with the group at the first level, right? The first level is, let's just call out the skeptics. Sometimes the skeptic is the decision maker. Sometimes they're not. Regardless, you're never getting to a decision maker until you figure out who the skeptics are, what they're skeptical about, and can you work through that with the skeptic or with your champion? The other benefit of this, and then I'll shut up. The other benefit of using this question of, hey, who's the most skeptical? What are they skeptical about? You're now able to determine how much of a champion is this person really going to be for me in that room? How much is this person really going to advocate on my behalf? And the cool thing, the third part of this is that what happens is that that person now starts to trust you more because you said you understand what they're about to go through and that you're trying to make it easy for them. That means that you get a little plus one in the trust column compared to maybe a competitor they're also talking to. Because very few people ask this question. They go down this other path of like, hey, you know, oh, who's the decision maker? What is, you know, can I talk to him? Can I get an introduction to him? When can I get you know, and it's just because we're a copycat league and we've just been taught to do that all these years. And I used to do it. So I'm not, believe me, I'm not perfect. I used to do it too. Okay. Yeah. I'll stop now.
No, it's a good point. No, this is great. This is great because I think somehow in the other side of the scale where you are not trained so much, you are given this kind of false confidences that you can overcome anything.
Yes.
So all you need to be is in front of the decision maker and you can do it.
No. Yeah, you're not. You're not. I agree with you 100%. And you know, you're sort of going down that path of objection handling.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, if I'm in front of the person, I can handle their objections. You know, Look, last time I checked, according to my wife, nobody wants to be handled. My wife doesn't need me to handle her. Okay. What you have to do, and I think really good salespeople have known this for a long time, is that you don't handle the objection, right? You don't get the big book of objections. Oh, they bring up the competitor. Here's how we differentiate from the competitor. No. That's not the right thing to do. Not yet. You actually need to marinate in the objection first before you handle it. Hey, when you say you like that feature, how important is that feature to you even making this decision? That's marinating in that objection.
Yeah.
Because I ask the answer I need to know. Because if they're like, oh, it's a must have. Well, I may not like the fact that I don't have it, but at least now I have a reason.
Yeah.
Right. Now I've got something logical. Right. So that's the part. You have to marinate in the objection and understand where their concern is coming from. And how important is that concern in relation to the objection they're bringing up versus us just trying to handle it because of the big book of objections. And here's what you say when they say this.
I love the fact that you use the word concern, because Richard, for a long time, I thought that the word objection is too sales out in the process, because finally we are trying to sell something to somebody. He's not objecting. Objection is our point of view. They're objecting.
Right.
But actually what he's expressing is concern.
I've never heard about this. There's a new chapter to the book. I dropped that word and then you picked up on it in a way that I even haven't thought about it. Thank you. That's cool. Okay.
So we have to be respectful about somebody who is going to give us money. And as you said, they're trying to fix experience. They're trying to do something with their money or their time and their energy. They're entertaining you. They're not objecting.
They have concerns.
They're expressing. Yeah, they have concerns. Wouldn't you say that, okay, this car has only 200,000 miles warranty. What happens after that? That's not objection.
Right. Yeah, that's not an objection. That's a concern.
It's a concern. Right. And so it's legitimate. And I think our classifying it as objection actually projects an idea that we are in conflict with the customer.
I just wrote this down. Like you nailed it. I agree. Thinking of things as objections is very selfish.
Yeah. Right.
Right. If you think about it as if it's their concern, then that's selfless.
Yeah.
And you're there to help solve that concern.
Exactly.
That's a really, really great point.
Exactly. So, yeah. So that's one of the things I always thought that we need to address, because a lot of the terminology that we use in sales is there a conflict? Yes, there is a conflict with my competitor, not with my customer.
Yep.
But it seems that we have somehow positioned the customer as the enemy.
As the enemy. Yes, totally. Yeah, we create our own conflict around objections.
Is it
100%? 100%. I totally agree with you.
Right.
Thanks. Thank you. I love that.
You're most welcome, Richard. So let's talk about a bit about objection and competition tactics. So the people have concerns. You need to address them. And there would be situations where the competition will have something that you don't have. It may be price, it may be features, it may be, I don't know, support. There could be n number of differentiators, just like you have vis-a-vis your competitor. Is the key discovering the concerns, or is it positioning related? I know this is a little ambiguous.
Yeah, No. I think, you know, it's that classic chicken and an egg situation, right? Which comes first? I think it's both, right? I think we should know the objections they're going to give us, right? We should know their concerns are going to be around competition, features, commercial terms, right? Could they build it themselves versus buy it themselves, you know, versus buying, right? There's five or six standard concerns and objections that they have. There are a couple of ways to handle them, right? And through the process, one is to bring them up ahead of time. It's kind of like, you know, it's like when I said, hey, who's going to be the most skeptical? Well, I'm bringing that up because I already know that that's going to be a concern, right? Mm. They're going to have to go through that part of the process. You can try to pre-handle certain things if you want, right? You can say things like, you know, hey, before we get into this demo, what are the parts that are the most important to you? Because I don't need to kill you with death by mouse click, mm. right? So that their objection isn't, well, I didn't see what I wanted to see, yeah. which they may never even tell you from a demo.
Yeah.
You can pre-handle the commercial terms conversation in certain ways. Hmm. So I think this one's a give-get. It's a two-way street. And the important thing is not to know how to handle it, but to your point, know how to navigate it.
Yeah.
Right? Like I wrote something the other day that said, you know, objections aren't, you know, those are really just more like road signs on telling you how to get to where you need to go.
Yeah.
Like they're just part of the map. And we shouldn't be shocked when we see them. We shouldn't be shocked that we got a detour all of a sudden. We should expect there to be detours.
Yeah.
So I think if I'm understanding your question correctly, I'm not sure I answered it because I got a little long-winded there, but.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, these are not black and white. These are not straightforward situations. It's very, very subjective, right? So, I mean, you may discuss whatever, but it may not be applicable in a scenario that somebody may come up with. So it is more to generally understand the space and get your understanding at a higher level so that you can then apply. I mean, it's like what you said earlier, that you have to understand the philosophy. If you understand the philosophy, then the methodology, then the application, all that will follow. Right. But you have to understand the core. And the core is the philosophy, right?
Yeah. And it's a little bit like, as a salesperson, I feel like this is the part where we are a little bit like a doctor, where we need to have a certain level of bedside manner.
Yeah.
Right? And look, we've all been to, you know, if I go and have a heart problem or a brain problem, and I can go to UCSF here, which is one of the world's greatest for that thing, I may not be that concerned with my doctor's bedside manner. I'm more concerned with his ability to do the job and keep me alive or for her to keep me alive, right? Yeah. But I think in sales, it's a little bit different in that regards, where we have to have a better bedside manner. We have to create a better experience for the buyer.
Yeah.
And spending time talking about it a little bit.
Yeah. I agree. Let's get to the closing and I sort of can imagine what this is about, but let's talk about this never-ending journey.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, again, you know, like a lot of professions, things change and shift, and we need to self-educate. Again, if I go back to, you know, the doctor, I want my doctor, if she's my heart surgeon or brain surgeon, I want her to have been reading up on the latest stuff that's going on, right? Same thing as with a lawyer or an accountant, like they need to know the tax laws. Same thing with sales. We have to be self-educating along the way. We have to keep doing things and keep an open mind. Like your whole thing you just taught me about this concern versus objection. Like my mind is racing about trying to write something about that because that's a great point of view, really good point of view. So we have to be willing to be a little more humble and try to learn and hear something from somebody else, which I will say is probably my biggest Achilles heel. You know, as a Gen Xer, I spent so much of my life figuring it out on my own all by myself that I don't think I need help, when in fact I probably do. So there was a part of that book, of the book at the end, where I talk about this never-ending journey, which was a realization I had to go through. Through my own experiences that I wanted to, you know, encourage others. I think younger generations are a little more adept at learning because they have so much easier access than you and I did. Like you and I usually had to physically go somewhere to learn more. Like we had to go to the library, right? Yeah. Like the library didn't show up on my computer every day. So I think they're a little bit more open to that.
Right.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Great. This has been a fascinating conversation. And
I love it. This has been great.
Thank you, Richard, for making time. And I'm really happy that we had this conversation. I look forward to having more. I mean, the 6 months, you have 6 months now to write the next book, right?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. I've got it. It's called The Manager's Journey, The Sales Manager's Journey. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It's definitely been, a different kind of conversation I've had. Like I've had a lot, when you write a book, people actually come on podcasts. And so, I really appreciate your approach to this because we spent some time around the mental game of writing a book and realizing that. And I hope other people who are listening, can get something out of that, as well as, some sales tactics and strategies, which in reality, a lot of the stuff I teach, a lot of stuff in sales, you use in the real world anyway. There's nothing in there that you haven't learned. Oh yeah, I've had that conversation before.
Right. Thank you, Richard. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.